You are listening to the History of Religions and Their Gods, and I am your host, the Skeptical Ghost Heathen. You're definitely going to want to stop at the Jiffy Pop and get yourself a can of Vienna sausages and a Diet Dr. Pepper or a tab. Hello, heathens, and welcome back to the show. Well, can you believe it? This is a brand new season, and I hope you enjoyed season 6 as we broke down Michael McDonald's, the Homeric Epics and the Gospel of Mark. But this year is a brand new season, and this is episode 1 of season 7. Now, in this episode, we will dig way back into Israel's deep, dark history, the gods that were worshipped there, and the gods that walked the earth there. Now, what do we know about the God of the entire universe? Should we be asking ourselves, does he really exist? Or should we be asking, who was he really? So if you're ready, let's hop into our time machines and let's go find God. The early Israelite culture, it can't be separated easily from the culture belonging to their Canaanite neighbors. Because the highlands of Israel, during the Iron Age period, being from around 1200 to 900 BCE, it seems to reflect a lot of continuity with the Canaanite, or, better said, Western Semitic culture, during the preceding period both in the highlands as well as in the contemporary cities on both the coast and in the valleys. Now this continuity, it's reflected in ancient scripts, steles, inscriptions, both linear as well as cuneiform alphabetic scripts, and they're shown in inscriptions found in the highlands as well as in the valleys and on the coast during both the Late Bronze Age, as far back as 1500 all the way through 1200 BCE, and in the Iron Age, being 1200 through 900 BCE. Additionally, this continuity is also quite visible in language itself. Although Hebrew and Canaanite are the linguistic labels that are applied to the two languages for the periods in this region, they are, however, indistinguishable from each other. You can't tell them apart. This is in the period of the Iron Age. Now, for example, most scholars argue that the Gezer calendar was written in Hebrew, where others want to say, no, the language is written in Canaanite, because both Canaanite and the Hebrew language so closely overlap that the ability to tell them apart is usually premised more on historical data versus linguistics. We can actually see ancient awareness in the close linguistic relationship, if not identity, between Canaanite and Hebrew, and it's found in the post-exilic literature found in the works such as Isaiah 19:18, which includes Hebrew in the designation. The language of Canaan, or Judean, in 2 Kings 18:26, Isaiah 36:11, and 2 Chronicles 32:18, and Nehemiah 13:24. And similarly, in Canaanite and Israelite material, culture cannot be distinguished by specific features found during the time of the Judges. And in Jewish tradition, the period of the Judges is between 1200 and 1000 BCE. For example, we have cooking pots and clay storage jars discovered in Gilo, an ancient city in Judah, that represented a pottery tradition that's continuous with the Late Bronze Age. And items such as the four-bedroom house or collard-rimmed store jars and hewn cisterns, otherwise known as primitive wells, once thought to distinguish the Israelite culture from the highlands from the Canaanite culture of the coast and the valleys. But we cannot tell them apart at this point in time. But now it appears that these items are also attested on the coastal areas in the valleys or in the Transjordan too. Also, both indigenous tradition and influence from the coast and the valleys of the Canaanites are equally represented in the highlands and burial patterns of the Israelites. There are multiple primary burials in caves that continue in the hill country from the late Bronze Age all the way through the Iron Age. There are also acrosoleus and bench tombs, two types of rock-cut tombs that are present on the coast that also appear in the highlands during the Iron Age I period, 1200 BCE. Now, the Canaanite, or Semitic people of the West's background of Israel's culture, is extended to the realm of religion as well. And this is evident from the terminology that they use for cultic sacrifices, as well as personnel. Because in Biblical Hebrew, the sacrificial language with corresponding terms in Ugaritic and or Phoenician includes the word zeba, which literally means slaughtered offering, a biblical term applied to sacrifices in the cults of Yahweh, as seen in Genesis 46:1, Exodus 10:25, 18:12, Hosea 3:4, 6:6-9:4, and Amos 5:25, and Tabal in 2 Kings 10:19 and 24. Additionally, the words zeba hayamim means the annual slaughtered offering, as seen in 1 Samuel 1:21, 2:19 and 26, and selamim, which means offering of well-being or greeting, as seen in Leviticus 3. There are many more words and terms of the offerings and sacrifices that are shared between the Hebrew and Ugaritic languages. It's assumed, for example, that the biblical word hola, not hola as in hello in Spanish, as seen in Leviticus 1 and Judges 11:30, is equivalent to a Ugaritic word which both denote an offering that is entirely consumed by fire. Now, the hola sacrifice belonged not only to the cult of Yahweh in Jerusalem and elsewhere, but also to the cult of Baal in Samaria, as seen in 2 Kings 10:24. Now, we can also observe a ritual of general expiation or forgiveness that was not only an Israelite feature in such passages as Leviticus 16 and 17:11, as well as Genesis 32:21. However, it was also a Ugaritic phenomenon, as found in several ancient inscriptions. So we can see both Ugaritic text and biblical rituals, such as Leviticus 4-5, that equally provide divine forgiveness. And this incidence of highly specialized sacrificial terms between the two texts points to a common Semitic heritage, as well as a shared tradition. Although there are other terminological parallels between Israelite and Ugaritic, as well as Phoenician texts that are found in Mesopotamian culture, and these links show us just how closely related Israelite and Canaanite cultures were, and how they were actually one and the same for centuries. Even the biblical names and terms that also have Canaanite backgrounds to them for the cult of personnel such as priests, as seen as 2 Kings 10:19, or dedicated servants, as in Numbers 3:9, 8:19, and a dozen other cultic practitioners, as found in Ezra 2:43, Nehemiah 3:26, 1 Chronicles 9:2. They all have a cultic function in Israelite religion as well, while using the same exact titles as their Canaanite Phoenician neighbors. Furthermore, the Hebrew biblical, the Tent of Meetings, also derived from Canaanite prototypes. Comparing 2 Samuel to Ugaritic inscriptions. And to be sure, parallels in terminology do not establish parallels in cultural settings in each of these cases. However, cultural continuity appeared likely in these instances. It is therefore evident from many areas of culture that Israelite society drew heavily from its neighboring Canaanite culture and its traditions. Now, the evidence of the similarities between the Canaanite and Israelite societies, well, it's actually led to a major change in the general understanding of the relationship between the two groups. Because rather than viewing them as two separate cultures, well, scholars now prefer to define the Israelite culture as a subset of its parent Canaanite culture. There are, however, some Israelite features that are unattested in Canaanite sources, such as the old tradition of Yahweh's southern sanctuary, variously called Sinai in Deuteronomy 33:2, Judges 5:5, and Psalm 68:9, but also Paran, as seen in Deuteronomy 33:2, or sometimes Edom, per the author of Judges 5:4. And last but not least, he's also sometimes from Teoman, as seen in Habakkuk 3:3, and in the Cantillat Ajurad inscriptions. And Israel's earliest tradition of the Exodus from Egypt in Exodus 15:4. None of these features appear in any part of any type of Canaanite tradition. Now, Israel, in some form, was distinguished from Canaan right around 1200 BCE. And this is clear from an inscription found on a monument of the pharaoh Merneptah. This stele dates right around the fifth year of the pharaoh's reign, which would be 1208 BCE. And it does mention both Israel as well as Canaan. And the inscription reads, "The princes are prostrate, saying mercy. Not one raises his head among the nine bows. Desolation is for Tekenah. Hatti is pacified. Plundered is Canaan with every evil. Carried off is Ashkelon. Seized upon is Gezer. Yanoam is made that which does not exist. And Israel is laid to waste. His seed is not. Huru is become a widow for Egypt. All lands together, they are pacified. Everyone who is restless, he has been bound." Now, the purpose of this inscription, it was to celebrate Egyptian power over various lands in Syro-Palestine. Hatti and Huru stand for the whole region of Syro-Palestine, where Canaan and Israel, well, they represent the smaller units within the larger area, and Gezer and Ashkelon and Yanoam, the three cities that sit within the region. So in this hymn to the power of the pharaoh, all of these listed places on the inscription of the stele stand underneath Egyptian rule, Egyptian power. The text provides distinction between Israel and Canaan, as they both seem to constitute two separate terms in the text. Now, some scholars, they like to point out that the two terms are further distinguished than just that, because the word Canaan is written using a special linguistic feature called determinative, which means indicating that the term is a land, a piece of property, a nation, or a region. Whereas the word Israel is written denoting a people. So drawing some historical conclusions from this difference in the Scrabble use of the determinatives has proven to be problematic. Because on one hand, if the determinatives were used accurately by the Egyptian scribe who wrote this text, then Israel as a people were established by 1200 BCE. While on the other hand, other scholars believe that the scribe did not use the two determinatives consistently in other texts, and therefore challenged the accuracy of their use in the Merneptah stele. But if the determinatives were used correctly by this ancient Egyptian scribe, then Israel stands for a people that were living in the region of the highland country outside of Canaan's main city, rather than designated Israel as a geographical area in the highlands. In any case, Israel and Canaan are differentiated in the text, and in some way, they also represent different entities, at least to the scribe who inscribed the Merneptah stele. Either way, Israel, whether a people or a place or a region, was differentiated as early as 1200 from its Canaanite parents. But I have seen on Christian websites that they do refer to the Merneptah stele as the Israel stele, because it is proof that Israel was a nation during this period, versus being a people. So we need to keep that in mind, that more than likely this scribe meant people, as even later Jewish poets, such as the author for Isaiah 52 and 53, who recognizes Israel in metaphor as a people, and not referring to it as a geographical location. Pretty cool stuff so far, right? You still following along? You guys staying awake? But 11th century BCE evidence that's currently available to us and to scholars presents a dilemma. Because again, on one hand, my left, the historical understanding of the period has been tremendously enhanced by archaeological research. Where on the other, using my right, the data does not answer many of our important questions regarding this early Israel. But as of right now, guys, it's impossible to establish. Impossible to establish, I say again, on the basis of archaeological information, any distinction whatsoever between the Israelites and the Canaanites in this period, say 1200 to 1000 BCE. So the archaeological evidence that we have so far to today, almost Halloween, probably Thanksgiving by the time you hear the episode, but it does not provide us with a clear set of criteria for distinguishing an Israelite site from a Canaanite site, meaning we cannot tell one from the other. Although of such features that we talked about before, such as the four-room house, very nice, I'm sure, collared rim storage jars and hewn cisterns, which are things or places built to catch or store rainwater in an Iron Age site in the Central Highlands, it continues to be taken as a sign of Israelite settlement. However, there is also inscriptional evidence that likewise is of limited help to us here, because down to the 10th century BCE, the languages and the scripts of the epigraphic source do not provide such distinction between the two cultures. Again, we cannot tell them apart with exception to some of these other features. Additionally, biblical evidence isn't much help to us here either, and for obvious reasons. Though they can contain some kernels and golden nuggets once you remove the bullshit and the magic from it, they can reveal some historical insight for us. However, the accuracy of this information is complicated due to the literary backdating, the use of symbolism and exaggeration in writing and metaphor, but also because of centuries of textual transmission and interpretation. Now, indeed, the narrative material found in the Hebrew Bible that's supposed to pertain to the Iron Age dates largely to the later half of the monarchy, right around 800 BCE, and removed at least two or three centuries from the events that would have taken place during that time. Also, in some cases, the biblical record complicates interpretational matters. Because the difficulty of distinguishing between Israelite and Canaanite, well, it's exacerbated by biblical references to other groups, not just the Israelites and the Canaanites. I mean, we have the Gibeonites to talk about in Joshua 9:15, or the Jeremielites in 1 Samuel 27:10 and 30:29. And then, of course, just the Kenites in Judges 1:16 and 4:11, 1 Samuel 27:10 and 30:29. And then there's the descendants of Rahab, as seen in Joshua 6:25, Caleb, the Kenizzite, in Joshua 14:13, and again in 21:12, my favorite album, by the way, and the Canaanite cities of Hefer and Tirzah all became part of Israel. See Exodus 6:15. Now, presumably, the other groups and places were absorbed into Israel as well. Furthermore, the other groups that are mentioned as being dispossessed of the land by the Israelites being the Hittites, who Amos 1, the Egyptian prince, chased out of Canaan to protect the port of Byblos, and the Hivites, the Perizzites, and the Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. Joshua 3:10, 9:1, 11:13, and 12:8. Now for sure, folks, while some of these group names are highly suspect, I'm sure, and reflect a later attempt to try to reconstruct the history of Israel's early development in the land, the point that some of them indicate a social complex composition of the highlands in Israel remains valid. And finally, Current attempts to distinguish Israel from Canaan in the 10th century are marked by their own limitations. Now, to pose one difficulty, although Israelite and Canaanite societies cannot be distinguished on the basis of archaeological evidence alone, archaeological features do not constitute all of the criteria for making historical distinctions. Even if there were not a single criterion for establishing clear distinctions based on culture. And currently, there is no current criterion in place. Now, maybe some of the early Israelites did perceive themselves as radically different from their Canaanite parents, for political reasons or greed to take control of the city ports, such as Byblos or Tyre. However, any information bearing on such perception is still unavailable for this time period. Although it could be inferred from older biblical texts such as Judges 5, although not written until after the exile, 537 BCE, the evidence that is still available, one can conclude that although largely Canaanite according to our current cultural data, Israel expressed a distinct sense of origins and a deity and possessed distinct larger geographical holdings in the hill country by the end of the Iron Age. 800 BCE, prior to the Assyrian invasions. Now, the Canaanite character of Israelite culture, say that again, the Canaanite character of Israelite culture largely shaped the many ways that ancient Israelites communicated their religious understanding for their Yahweh deity. This point may be extended to the people of the highlands who came to be known as the people of Israel, comprised of many numerous and unique cultures and different groups that included Canaanites, whose heritage marked every aspect of Israelite society. In summary, early Israel from 1200 BCE to 800 BCE was in fact by large Canaanite in culture, including their religious beliefs and understandings and traditions, their cultic practices. To non-distinctive groups living as close as neighbors for centuries until something changed politically, sociologically, and theologically. Or, as I said before, reasons of greed, control, and power. All we know by this point in history is that the land of Canaan was heavily desired by foreign overlords and tradespeople who wanted to control the ports of Byblos, the economic hub of the Levant, between 1100 and 700 BCE before it began to suffer. Then everyone desired Tyre as the new economic point of interest. Over time, Israel, or the people who identified themselves as Israel, inherited a local cultural tradition from the late Bronze Age 3300 BCE, a culture that was continuous with that of Canaanite culture of the coast and the valleys all the way through the Iron Age, 1100 to 700 BCE. In fact, archaeologically, scholars can see that the realm of religious beliefs during this time was consistent with the Canaanite traditions and religious practices. However, one may not identify the local deities prior to and during the emergence of Israel by equating Ugaritic religion with Canaanite religion. However, Ugaritic evidence is pertinent to the study of Canaanite religion since the inscriptions of the late Bronze Age and the first half of the Iron Age period in Canaan, and they indicate that the deities of the land did in fact include El, Baal, Asherah, and Anat. All of these are the major divinities known from Ugaritic texts who were also divinities in Canaan, who were also celebrated and worshipped and paid cult to by the people who had referred to themselves as Israel. Now, the proper name El is contained in a 12th century BCE inscription from Kubar El Walida, which lies about 10 kilometers from Gaza. Then the Lakish Ur, dated to the 13th century BCE, contains another inscription that is probably referring to a goddess, And it reads, "An offering to my lady Eilat." And the word for lady literally means, "O great one," while marked with a feminine ending. And goddess is a regular title, although not exclusive for Asherah in the Ugaritic text. And in these epithets, in the Lakish Ur, more than likely would be referring to Asherah as well. And then we have an arrowhead from El Kadar, a city near Bethlehem, dating around 1100 BCE, that reads, "Son of Anat." Additionally, Baal too is mentioned in a 15th century BCE Tanakh letter, and in a 14th century BCE El Armana letter from Tyre. The element that states Baal also occurs in an inscription from Lachish, as either both a divine name as in a god, or as an element used for personal human names. Now this is interesting, right? Other deities or royal members of the family also enjoyed the cultic devotion sometime around the second millennium in Canaan. So for example, or additionally, the divine ancestral god and the lady are known from the late second millennium inscriptions too from Lachish. So given that the Ugaritic inscriptions and biblical texts attest to so many of these deities, their religious practices and notions, the Ugaritic text may be used with caution for religious material in the West Semitic sphere, which Israelite tradition ultimately inherited. Now, according to biblical tradition, these deities continued on in various ways during what scholars call the period of judges within Israel from 1150 to approximately 1025 BCE. While few, if any, of the following texts actually date to the pre-monarchic period, being anything prior to 1000 to 930 BCE, they may reflect earlier religious conditions, or at least help suggest some of the range in the deities that were being worshipped in pre-monarchic Israel. Just like the god Shechem in Judges 9:46. See also in 8:33, it is called El Berit, which scholars have unanimously all identified as the title of El. Now, religious devotion to the Asherah, perhaps, lies behind a verse found in Genesis 49:25. And the Asherah, which is the symbol named after the goddess Asherah, is explicitly described in Judges 6:25-26. And then the word Baal forms the theophoric element in the biblical name Jerubbaal, as seen in Judges 6:32 and 8:35. There are also two members of the family of Saul, Eshbaal, as seen in 1 Chronicles 8:33 and 9:39, and Meribbaal, as seen in 1 Chronicles 8:34 and 9:40. And likewise, these are names that contain the element Baal in them, the Canaanite Baal. There's only one proper name, Shamgar ben Anat, is found in Judges 5:6, that attests the name of Anat in the period of the Judges. But the lack of either inscriptional or biblical evidence for Anat on her own would suggest the absence of a cult being devoted to her during this time as well. However, during the period of the Judges, the major deities in the territory of Israel indeed included Yahweh as a local weather manifestation, El as the creator deity, Baal, the major deity of storm and war, and perhaps Asherah too, the goddess of fertility. Now, some scholars have used this evidence to demonstrate that Israel in the period of the Judges, 1150 to 1025 BCE, was heavily syncretistic, that it incorporated Canaanite elements into an Israelite religion that was originally non-Canaanite. Now, for sure, some biblical texts view Israel's proto-history at Sinai as a time when Canaanite elements would have been alien to Yahwism. For example, Deuteronomy 32 expresses life in the wilderness in the following terms, and I begin, quote, "The Lord alone did lead him," and him being Israel, "and there was no foreign god with him." However, the claim here is potentially misleading on two accounts. Now first, Religious elements identified as Canaanite, they were not syncretistic. At least, not in the sense that such elements were not original to Israel. Because the biblical historiography, identified in Deuteronomy 32, it omits any reflection of the fact that Israel's cultural heritage was largely Canaanite. Indeed, it implicitly denies this idea. Second, the evidence that Canaanite deities such as El, Baal, and Asherah, who is the Queen of Heaven, were objects of Israelite religious devotion separate from the cult of Yahweh in the period of the Judges, it's scant. And both of these claims are largely extensions of biblical historiography, because the historical works of the Bible view the religion of the Judges period in this particular way. Then some scholars conclude that the biblical view represent a historical reality. However, in various ways, the god El, Baal, and Asherah, or at least the symbol that was named after her, were essentially related to Yahweh and the cult of this deity in the period of the Judges, 1100 to 1000 BCE. So basically, some Israelites may have perceived themselves as different people from the Canaanites with separate religious traditions of Yahweh, and separate traditions of origins in Egypt, for at least some component of Israel anyway, and separate geographical holdings in the hill country contributed to the Israelites' sense of difference from their Canaanite parenting neighbors, who were inhabiting the coast and the valleys. Now, nevertheless, Israelite and Canaanite cultures shared a great deal in common, and religion was no exception. Deities and their cults in the Iron Age Israel represented aspects of the cultural continuity with the indigenous Late Bronze Age culture in the contemporary urban and the coast and in the valleys. Because the examples of El, Baal, and the symbol of the Asherah illustrate this continuity for the period of the Judges. Now, at this point in the episode, I want to discuss Yahweh and El and their relationship with each other. Because the actual origins of the God of Israel was, in fact, the Canaanite creator deity El. Now, this reconstruction may be inferred from two pieces of information. First being, the name of Israel is not a Yahwistic name with a divine element of Yahweh in it, but rather an El name, with the element El. This fact alone suggests that El was the original chief god of the group that would be later named Israel, and not Yahweh. Second, in Genesis 49:24-25, well, we get a series of El epithets that are separate from the mention of Yahweh in verse 18. Yet early on, Yahweh is understood as Israel's God in distinction to El. If we look at Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 through 9, it cast Yahweh in the role of one of the sons of El, and here called Elyon.
When the Most High Elyon gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated humanity, he fixed the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of divine beings. For Yahweh's portion is his people. Jacob, his allotted heritage.
So this passage here presents an order in which each deity receives his own nation. Israel was a nation that evidently Yahweh received according to this author. It also suggests that Yahweh originally was a warrior god from Sinai, or Paran, or Edom or Teman, depending on who you ask. Yahweh was also seemingly known separately from the Canaanite El, and at a very early point in ancient Israel's history, perhaps due to trade with Edom, Median. Yahweh entered secondarily into the religions of Israel's highlands. Passages such as Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 through 9, demonstrate a literary indication of the initial assimilation of Yahweh as a southern warrior god into the larger highland pantheism, That was headed by the god El. Other texts that we have point to Asherah, who was El's consort at one point in time, and Baal as well, as other deities inside the same pantheon of Israelite gods. And over time, El and Yahweh were identified, while Yahweh and Baal coexisted and later would compete as warrior gods, brother to brother, face to face, fist to fist. As we will discuss shortly, one element of this competition involved Yahweh's assimilation of language, as well as motifs that were originally associated with, at one point, his brother to his competitor, Baal. Now, one obvious indication that Yahweh and El were identified at an early stage is that there are no biblical polemics against El. Not one bit. The authors don't kill its priests or blow up and burn and torch its altars. At an early point, Israelite tradition identified El along with Yahweh. Not one and the same, as some apologists will try to argue. But it's for this reason that the Hebrew Bible so rarely distinguishes anything between El and Yahweh. And over time, the name El developed into a generic noun simply meaning God. And it was also compatible with the loss of El's distinct character in Israelite religious texts. Elohim, God, is Yahweh. Now, the first word in this verse reflects the development of the name of the god El into a generic meaning for God. In this verse, the noun forms part of a superlative expression proclaiming the incompatible divine status of Yahweh. The phrase, God of gods, may be compared to use other superlative expressions of this type in the Bible, such as King of Kings, as seen in Daniel 2:37 and Ezra 7:12. Also, the name of the biblical book, Song of Songs 1:1, and the opening word for the first speech in Ecclesiastics, Vanity of Vanities 1:2. Additionally, the priestly theological treatment of Israel's early religious history in Exodus 6:2-3 identifies the old god El Shaddai with Yahweh. In this passage, Yahweh appears to Moses, and it reads, "And God said to Moses, Hey, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and then to Jacob as El Shaddai. But my name is Yahweh. I did not make myself known to them." So this passage reflects the fact that Yahweh was unknown to the patriarchs at the time. Rather, they worshipped the Canaanite god El. And there's also some understanding, some evidence, that although the Israelites were worshipping the creator god El, that the Yahweh deity may have been some Eastern royal family member or king who ultimately took the role as god or lord over the region in return for support to the Israelites, in return for protecting his territory and his region from foreign kings. Much like Egyptian pharaohs, they were gods, but they were also kings on earth. But we'll talk more about that later. But we have an inscriptional text from Deir Allah, a site just north of Jericho that sits across the Jordan River, and it shows the epithet Shaddai. In the inscriptions, the Shaddai is not applied to the great creator god El. Perhaps the author of Exodus 6, 2-3 did not know or make this distinction. Rather, he identified Yahweh instead with the traditions of the great Canaanite god El. And so if Shaddai is not connected to El in this inscription, then who is Shaddai?
"And God said to Moses, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai, but my name is Yahweh. I did not make myself known to them.
In the Deir all inscriptions, Shaddai as well as Elohim, rather than Elohim, are both present independently.
Scholars translate this simply as Shaddai gods.
Shaddai gods, taken to mean nothing too specific, fertility, mountain or wilderness gods. However, discomfort over this is sometimes interpreted as controversy, leaving room for other suggestions, like a relation to the destroyer aspect of God mentioned in Etalia during the Egyptian affair from Shaddad. Though such an etymology appears to be less direct. The form of the phrase El Shaddai fits the pattern of the divine names from the ancient Near East, exactly as it is in the case with El Olam, or El Elyon, or El Beit. As such, El Shaddai can convey several different semantic relations between the two words, and among them, the deity of a place called Shaddai, or a deity possessing the quality of Shaddai, and a deity who is also known by the name Shaddai. Either way, the author for Exodus 6 conflated the Canaanite creator god El with another god or place called Shaddai, neither of which are related to Yahweh.
There's been a recent study of inscriptional onomastica, which is the study of the origins of ancient names. And it is compatible with the historical reconstruction of the identification of El with Yahweh in early Israelite tradition. Now, the study lists all the proper names that have theophoric elements, simply names applied to gods in Israelite inscriptions, all dating sometime after the beginning of the period of the monarchy, so around 900 BCE, give or take. But there are 557 names with Yahweh as the divine element. Another 77 names that contain an El, E-L. And another handful of names with the divine component, Baal. But no names referring to the goddesses Asherah or Anat. But the few proper names that we have with divine names of Anat and Asherah do not seem to reflect a cult to these deities. Baal, however, may be the sole exception. And scholars believe that the names with the element of the name El in them historically reflect the identification of Yahweh and El by the time that these names appeared in this inscription. Just as no cult for Anat, and perhaps Asherah in the Israelite religion. Also, there is no distinct cult attested for El except in his new identity as Yahweh. Like most royal kings, a cult would be built up around them, where the deity or the god would be an extension of their national or regional power. In Israel, the characteristics and the epithets of El became part of the repertoire for the description of Yahweh, and like a king being deified as the great creator god. In both texts and iconography, El is depicted as an elderly bearded figure, big white flowing beard, who is enthroned and sometimes seated before other individual deities. Just like what we surveyed in Deuteronomy 32, where the creator god El assigns Yahweh, who is his son, to Israel. And sometimes he's seated before a divine council, known by a variety of expressions. This feature of El being seated in front of a divine council is also attested in Phoenician inscriptions. In one inscription, El is called the Ageless One. And in another, Anat and Asherah both affirm the eternity of his wisdom. His eternity is also expressed in his epithet, the Father of Years. In another inscription, Asherah addresses El as, "You are great, O El, and indeed wise. Your hoary beard instructs you."
I have no idea what that means. Then Anat's threat in another text likewise also mentions El's flowing gray beard. And similarly, Yahweh too is often described as the aged patriarchal God in Psalms 102:28, as well as Job 36:26, Isaiah 40:28, Daniel 7:9, Esdras 8:20, Tobit 13:6, and Ben-Sirah 18:30. And in these texts here too, Yahweh is described by these authors as enthroned amidst the assembly of divine beings, as in 1 Kings 22:19, and Isaiah 6:1-8, and a handful more. Later biblical texts continued with the long tradition of an aged Yahweh enthroned before the heavenly hosts. And Daniel 7:9-14, as well as verse 22, describe Yahweh as the Ancient of Days and the Most High. He is enthroned amid the assembly of heavenly hosts, called in verse 18, the Holy Ones of the Most High. This description for angelic host actually derive from the older usage of the Hebrew word kedoshim, meaning holy ones, for the divine council in Psalms 89:6, Zechariah 14:5, Hosea 12:1. The tradition of the enthroned bearded God appears also in a Persian period coin marked with the word Yehud. This iconography belongs to a god, and apparently the authors for Yahweh thought that he too should share in the godlike tradition. I'm sure that if Yahweh was a divine manifestation of a king, a real king, well, he would most certainly want these attributes assigned to him or her as well. Because let's face it, Yahweh does take on some feminine features as well, mother and father. Or at least those who would write about him thought that he too should have these features, just like the great god El of Canaan and Israel. So the Canaanite-Israelite tradition of the divine council actually derived from the setting of a royal court, a human royal court built on earth with brick, stone, mortar, and mud. Not a floating celestial city up in the sky, as my friends would like to imagine. Because the language used for describing the Ugaritic divine court includes many further elements that derive from royal realia of the second millennium. Also, royal treaty terminology for tributes as well as royal gifts from the inferior king to a superior king all appear in the ancient Ugaritic inscriptions. But this language and terminology evolved in accordance with the court terminology of the dominant royal power of the time. But during the Israelite monarchy, sometime after 1000 BCE, the imagery of the divine council continued on from its late Bronze Age predecessors, the Canaanite kings and the royal family. Now, one scholar observed, named Brettler, that the Israelite monarchy also had a distinct impact on some of the features of this divine council. Roles in the divine council in Canaanite and early Israelite literature were generally not individuated. The only exception was the commander of the army of Yahweh in Joshua 5:13-15, which was based on a comparable role as in the Israelite army suggested in 1 Samuel 17:55, as well as 1 Kings 1:19 and Judges 4:7. And similarly, the divine destroyer that we talked about just a little while ago, right, of Exodus 12:13 and 1 Chronicles 21:15. This may be traced ultimately to the military of 1 Samuel 13:17 and 14:15, probably a class of fighters who were personified and secondarily incorporated and morphed into the divine realm, metaphorically, guys. If Yahweh was a deified king of Mesopotamia, a real live flesh and blood farting shit and smoking machine, his troops, commanders, would fit this role appropriately. This divine term seems to appear as either singular or as plural, acting on behalf of their divine lord or overlord. A king or ruler of a nation that sought to protect the people of Israel in return for their protecting the boundaries of his territory from foreign assaults. Now, there are two mysterious divine figures in Genesis, and they're evidently Mashitim, members of the divine council, or Yahweh's army, since they apply this term to themselves in Genesis 19:13. There are other features of divine council in Israelite literature that reflect later political developments. Because according to Brettler, Mezaret, meaning literally servant, applied first to royal officials in the post-exilic period, being 537 BCE, such as 1 Chronicles 27 and 2 Chronicles 17:19, and Esther 1:10 and 2:2, and secondarily referred to as angels, angelic beings, and other post-exilic texts, such as Psalms 103:21. This is the emerging of real people into angels or gods. Now, some biblical innovations in terminology of the heavenly court in the post-exilic period was more than likely modeled after the court of the reigning Mesopotamian power, the overlords of Israel. Additionally, the depiction of the Satan in Job 1-2, as well as Zechariah 3-6, have been traced back to Neo-Babylonian or Persian bureaucracies. Similarly, some scholars, they've identified that the angelic term for watcher, as in Daniel 4:10, 14, and 20, was based on the spies who watched over the empire on behalf of the Persian ruler. Similar to the angels who the Lord sent to Sodom for Lot before bringing the entire place down with fire. It wouldn't be a stretch to assume that the angelic messengers, or Meshet, were messengers of this Mesopotamian king, warning Lot that he needs to take his family and run because he's about to launch a preemptive strike on the people of Sodom, who were revolting against the foreign power, which there is evidence of. Now, it makes sense in Genesis when Lot offers up his daughters to the men of the city because he knew that they wouldn't do them any harm, whereas they wanted to humiliate the messengers of the Mesopotamian ruler. And yes, by sodomizing them, which evidently can be observed as something that Babylonians practiced. Lot, who was in cahoots with the Mesopotamian overlord, knew that if he gave the messengers over to the angry men of the city, that the Lord would destroy his city, which ultimately he did. And evidently, he burned it to the ground. Now, with respect to our two celestial heroes here, El and Yahweh, who this mystery ruler perhaps was conflated of, exhibited a similar compassionate disposition towards all of humanity, at least in literature anyway, like Kind El the Compassionate, or the Father of Humanity, where Yahweh is depicted as merciful and gracious, as in Exodus 34:6 and Psalms 86:15. He's also depicted as Father in Deuteronomy 32:6, Isaiah 63:16, 64:7 and Jeremiah 3:4, just to name a few. Both El and Yahweh also appear to humans in dream visions and functions as like their divine patrons. And like El, Yahweh, too, is a healing god, or a ruler, as in Genesis 20:17, Numbers 12:13, and 2 Kings 20 verses 5 as an example. Additionally, the monomorphic dwelling place for Yahweh is a tent, probably from REI, I bet, and it's traditionally referred to as the Tent of Meetings. Evidently, the God of the universe meets his higher-ups and generals inside of a tent, up on a mountaintop. Sounds like a king to me. Found in Exodus 33:7-11, Numbers 12:5, Deuteronomy 31:14. Now, these all recall the Tent of El, explicitly described in the Canaanite narrative of Elkanursa. Furthermore, the tabernacle, or temple of Yahweh, is referred to as boards in Exodus 26-40 and Numbers 3:36 and 4:31, while the dwelling of El is called the tabernacle or sometimes pavilion. Also, the dwelling of El is amid the cosmic waters, which is a theme evoked in the descriptions of Yahweh's abode in Jerusalem, as seen in Psalms 47:5-87, Isaiah 33:20-22, Ezekiel 47:1-2, and Zechariah 14:8. Additionally, the characteristics of the Yahweh in Deuteronomy 32:6-7 include some of the motifs that can be traced back to the traditional descriptions of the Canaanite creator god El. The Deuteronomist, who wrote, "Do you thus requite Yahweh, you foolish and senseless people? Is he not your father who created you, who made you and established you? Remember the old days, consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you." Now, obviously, this author is writing after the Babylonian captivity and is referring to this moment in Israelite history. But biblical scholars have long noted that every single line of this passage contains an element that is familiar from descriptions of El, known as Bull, El his father, El the king who establishes him. So like El, Yahweh too is also the father who establishes and creates. And the same verb in Hebrew recalls the epithet El, creator of the earth, from a Canaanite second millennium tradition, written some 1500 years before the Deuteronomist wrote his passage. And it's preserved in Hittite text, and it attributes this title to El, the creator god of Canaan and Israel. Now the passage in Genesis 14:19 likewise applies this title to El Elyon, itself another old El epithet. The phrase is also found in Neo-Punic inscriptions from Leptis Magna in Libya. Now, while Deuteronomy 32:6-7 applies some traditional traits of El onto his Yahweh, it also employs other features of El as well as a slap in the face to the people's character. The people, for example, are senseless, unlike El. Also, eternity evokes El's same epithet, and the years of many generations all echo El's Canaanite title, Father of Years. Like some Jewish poets' description of the Yahweh, many of Yahweh's epithets and features are traced back to those of El, who precedes Yahweh by centuries, if not a millennium. Especially traditions concerning the cultic site of Shechem. It illustrates the cultural process lying behind the Yahwistic inclusion of the old titles of El. Or stated differently, the Yahwistic assimilation to the old cultic sites of El. In the city of Shechem, the local god there was El Barit, or El of the Covenant. Very important to remember, the term Barit is the covenant. Judges 9:46. The word Ilberit appears as a late Bronze Age title for El in an ancient inscription, and in the patriarchal narratives, the god of Shechem, El, is called Elohi Yisrael. Elohi Yisrael. Simply put, the God of Israel. And it is presumed to be Yahweh, It's assumed scholars would like it to be Yahweh. In this case, a process of reinterpretation appears to be at work here. Because in the early history of Israel, when the cult of Shechem became Yahwistic, it inherited and absconded off with the El traditions of the site. Hence, Yahweh received the title of El Barit, God of the Covenant, the previous title belonging to El. This record illustrates, up to a point, how Canaanite and Israelite traditions were ultimately transmissioned over time. In conclusion, my friend, Israelite knowledge of the religious traditions of other deities was not due to only contact between Israel's Phoenician neighbors in the Iron Age, rather as a function of the identification of Yahweh at cultic sites of El, such as Shechem, as well as Jerusalem. The old religious lore of a deity such as El was ultimately inherited by the Yahwistic priesthood in Israel. Well, folks, in show business, that's what we call a wrap, baby. And I really hope that you enjoyed this episode. I really loved recording it. I mean, it was fantastic, and especially researching it, and I'm continuing to research it. But what a way to bust out of the gates. Brand new season. Season 7, brand new episode. Now, we have to give thanks to the guys that provided me with the information for this show. The first one is Mark White in his book, The Early History of God. Go pick it up, because we're just scratching the surface of it. Get it, order it, and let's get these guys paid for their work. Not me, I'm just sharing with you what I found interesting. Then the next guy I'm also friends with, Bernard Lamborel. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, brother. We'll fix it if it's not. But he has a book that is in the works called An Everlasting Quid Pro Quo. He has another book called The Covenant, which An Everlasting Quid Pro Quo will actually be somewhat replacing or updating it. And he has another book called To Be Done with Sodom. So give these guys a look. Purchase their books. Acknowledge them. They're the ones doing all the hard work here. I'm just the showman. But folks, if you're in the United States, have a great Thanksgiving. Eat a shitload of turkey. Drink plenty of wine. You know me. I'm going to be doing my what? Basil Hayden. You got that right. Basil Hayden and red wine and turkey and all the trimmings. And folks, for you outside of the United States, whatever you're doing on that day, man, make it worthwhile. Have an awesome, awesome week, guys. Take care. Bye.